This is Reading the Classics on KRBD, and I'm Pat Tully of the Ketchikan Public Library. This evening I'm going to read several sketches by Mark Twain. Before we get started, I want to encourage you to give to KRBD's Spring Fund Drive and help support the outstanding news, music, and storytelling that KRBD provides to our community. You can donate online at krbd.org or call the station at 907-225-9655. Thank you. So let's get started. About Barbers by Mark Twain. All things change except barbers, the ways of barbers, and the surroundings of barbers. These never change. What one experiences in a barber's shop the first time he enters one is what he always experiences in barber's shops afterwards until the end of his days. I got shaved this morning as usual. A man approached the door from Jones Street as I approached it from Main, a thing that always happens. I hurried up, but it was no use. He entered the door one little step ahead of me, and I followed in on his heels and saw him take the only vacant chair, the one presided over by the best barber. It always happened so. I sat down, hoping that I might fall heir to the chair belonging to the better of the remaining two barbers, for he had already begun combing his man's hair, while his comrade was not quite done rubbing and oiling his customer's locks. I watched the probabilities with a strong interest. When I saw that number two was gaining on number one, my interest grew to solicitude. When number one stopped a moment to make a change on a bath ticket for a newcomer and lost ground in the race, my solicitude rose to anxiety. When number one caught up again, and both he and his comrade were pulling the towels away and brushing the powder from their customers' cheeks, and it was about an even thing which one would say next, first, my very breath stood still with suspense. But when the culminating moment, number one, stopped to pass a comb a couple of times through his customer's eyebrows, I saw that he had lost the race by a single instant, and I rose indignant and quitted the shop, to keep from falling into the hands of number two. For I have none of that enviable firmness that enables a man to look calmly into the eyes of a waiting barber and tell him that he will wait for his fellow barber's chair. I stayed out 15 minutes and then went back, hoping for better luck. Of course, all the chairs were occupied now, and four men sat waiting, silent, unsociable, distraught, and looking bored, as men always do who are awaiting their turn in a barber shop. I sat down in one of the iron-armed compartments of an old sofa and put in the time for a while reading the framed advertisements of all sorts of quacked nostrums for dyeing and coloring the hair. Then I read the greasy names on the private bay rum bottles, read the names and noted the numbers on the private shaving cups in the pigeonholes, studied the stained and damaged cheap prints on the walls, of battles, early presidents, and voluptuous recumbent sultanas, and the tiresome and everlasting young girl putting on her grandfather's spectacles, excreated in my heart the cheerful canary and the distracting parrot that few barber shops are without. Finally, I searched out the least dilapidated of last year's illustrated papers that littered the foul center table, and conned their unjustifiable misrepresentation of old forgotten events. At last my turn came. A voice said, "Next," and I surrendered to number two, of course. It always happened so. I said meekly that I was in a hurry, and it affected him as strongly as if he had never heard it. He shoved up my head and put a napkin under it. He plowed his fingers into my collar and fixed a towel there. He explored my hair with his claws and suggested that it needed trimming. I said that I did not want it trimmed. He explored again and said it was pretty long for the present style. Better have a little taken off. It needed it behind especially. I said I had had it cut only a week before. He yearned over it reflectively for a moment and then asked with a disparaging manner, "Who cut it?" I came back at him promptly with a, "You did." I had him there. Then he fell to stirring up his lather and regarding himself in the glass, stopping now and then to get close and examine his chin critically or inspect a pimple. Then he lathered up one side of my face thoroughly and was about to lather the other when a dog fight attracted his attention, and he ran to the window and stayed and saw it out, losing 2 shillings on the result in bets with the other barbers, a thing which gave me great satisfaction. He finished lathering and then began to rub in the suds with his hand. He now began to sharpen his razor on an old suspender and was delayed a good deal on account of a controversy about a cheap masquerade ball he had figured at the night before in red cambric and bogus ermine as some kind of a king. He was so gratified with being chaffed about some damsel whom he had smitten with his charms that he used every means to continue the controversy by pretending to be annoyed at the chafing of his fellows. This matter begot more surveyings of himself in the glass, and he put down his razor and brushed his hair with elaborate care, plastering an inverted arch of it down on his forehead, accomplishing an accurate part behind, and brushing the 2 wings forward over his ears with nice exactness. In the meantime, the lather was drying on my face and apparently eating into my vitals. Now he began to shave, digging his fingers into my countenance to stretch the skin and bundling and tumbling my head this way and that as convenience in shaving demanded. As long as he was on the tough sides of my face, I did not suffer. But when he began to rake and rip and tug at my chin, the tears came. He now made a handle of my nose to assist him shaving the corners of my upper lip. And it was by this bit of circumstantial evidence that I discovered that a part of his duties in the shop was to clean the kerosene lamps. I had often wondered in an indolent way whether barbers did that or whether it was the boss. About this time I was amusing myself trying to guess where he would be most likely to cut me this time, but he got ahead of me and sliced me on the end of the chin before I had got my mind made up. He immediately sharpened his razor. He might have done it before. I do not like a close shave and would not let him go over me a second time. I tried to get him to put up his razor, dreading that he would make for the side of my chin, my pet tender spot, a place which a razor cannot touch twice without making trouble. But he said he only wanted to just smooth off one little roughness. And in the same moment, he slipped his razor along the forbidden ground, and the dreaded pimple signs of a close shave rose up smarting and answered to the call. Now he soaked his towel in bay rum and slapped it all over my face nastily. Slapped it over as if a human being ever yet washed his face in that way. Then he dried it by slapping with the dry part of the towel, as if a human being ever dried his face in such a fashion. But a barber seldom rubs you like a Christian. Next he poked bay rum into the cut place with his towel, then choked the wound with powdered starch, then soaked it with bay rum again, and would have gone on soaking and powdering it forevermore, no doubt, if I had not rebelled and begged off. He powdered my whole face now, straightened me up, and began to plow my hair thoughtfully with his hands. Then he suggested a shampoo and said my hair needed it badly, very badly. I observed that I shampooed it myself very thoroughly in the bath yesterday. I had him again. He next recommended some Smith's Hair Glorifier and offered to sell me a bottle. I declined. He praised the new perfume, Jones's Delight of the Toilette, and proposed to sell me some of that. I declined again. He tendered me a tooth wash atrocity of his own invention, and when I declined, offered to trade knives with me. He returned to business after the miscarriage of this last enterprise, sprinkled me all over, legs and all, greased my hair in defiance of my protest against it, rubbed and scrubbed a good deal of it out by the roots, and combed and brushed the rest, parting it behind and plastering the eternal inverted arch of hair down on my forehead, and then, while combing my scant eyebrows and defiling them with pomade, strung out an account of the achievements of a 6-ounce black and tan terrier of his, till I heard the whistle blow for noon, and knew I was 5 minutes too late for the train. Then he snatched away the towel, brushed it lightly about my face, passed his comb through my eyebrows once more, and gaily sang out, "Next!" This barber fell down and died of apoplexy 2 hours later. I am waiting over a day for my revenge. I am going to attend his funeral. The petrified man. Now, to show how really hard it is to foist a moral or a truth upon an unsuspecting public through a burlesque without entirely and absurdly missing one's mark, I will here set down two experiences of my own in this thing. In the fall of 1862, in Nevada and California, the people got to running wild about extraordinary petrifications and other natural marvels. One could scarcely pick up a paper without finding in it one or two glorified discoveries of this kind. The mania was becoming a little ridiculous. I was a brand new local editor in Virginia City, and I felt called upon to destroy this growing evil. We all have our benignant fatherly moods at one time or another, I suppose. I chose to kill the petrification mania with a very delicate satire. But maybe it was altogether too delicate, for nobody ever perceived the satire part of it at all. I put my scheme in the shape of a discovery of a remarkably petrified man. I had had a temporary falling out with Mr. X, the new coroner and justice of the peace of Humboldt, and thought I might as well touch him up a little at the same time and make him ridiculous, and thus combine pleasure with business. So I told, in patient, belief-compelling detail, all about the finding of a petrified man at Gravelly Ford, exactly 120 miles over a breakneck mountain trail from here where X lived, how all the savants of the immediate neighborhood had been to examine it. It was notorious that there was not a living creature within 50 miles of here, and how those savants all pronounced the petrified man to have been in a state of complete petrification for over 10 generations. And then, with a seriousness that I ought to have been ashamed to assume, I stated that as soon as Mr. X heard the news, he summoned a jury, mounted his mule, and posted off, with a noble reverence for official duty, on that awful 5 days' journey, through alkali, sagebrush, peril of body, imminent starvation, to hold an inquest on this man that had been dead and turned to everlasting stone for more than 300 years. And then, my hand being in, so to speak, I went on with the same unflinching gravity to state that the jury returned a verdict that the deceased came to his death from protracted exposure. This only moved me to higher flights of imagination, and I said that the jury, with that charity so characteristic of pioneers, then dug a grave and were about to give the petrified man Christian burial, when they found that for ages a limestone sediment had been trickling down the face of the stone against which he was sitting, and this stuff had run under him and cemented him fast to the bedrock, that the jury, they were all silver miners, canvassed the difficulty a moment, and then got out their powder and fuse, and proceeded to drill a hole under him, in order to blast him from his position, when Mr. X, with that delicacy so characteristic of him, forbade them, observing it would be a little less than sacrilege to do such a thing. From beginning to end, the petrified man squib was a string of roaring absurdities, albeit they were told with an unfair pretense of truth that even imposed upon me to some extent, and I was in some danger of believing in my own fraud. But really, I had no desire to deceive anybody, and no expectation of doing it. I depended on the way the petrified man was sitting to explain to the public that he was a swindle. Yet I purposely mixed up that with other things, hoping to make it obscure. And I did. I would describe the position of one foot, and then say his right thumb was against the side of his nose, and then talk about his other foot, and presently came back and say the fingers of his right hand were spread apart, then talk about the back of his head a little, then return and say the left thumb was hooked into the right little finger, and then ramble off about something else, and by drift back and remark that the fingers of the left hand were spread like those of the right. But I was too ingenious. I mixed it up rather too much. So all that description of the attitude, as a key to the humbuggery of the article, was entirely lost. For nobody but me ever discovered and comprehended the peculiar and suggestive position of the petrified man's hands. As a satire on the petrification mania, or anything else, My Petrified Man was a disheartening failure. For everybody received him in innocent good faith, and I was stunned to see that the creature I had begotten to pull down the wonder business with and bring derision upon it, calmly exalted to the grand chief place in the list of genuine marvels our Nevada had produced. I was so disappointed at the curious miscarriage of my scheme that at first I was angry and did not like to think about it. But by and by, when the exchanges began to come in with the petrified man copied and guilelessly glorified, I began to feel a soothing secret satisfaction. And as my gentleman's field of travels broadened, and by the exchanges I saw that he steadily and implacably penetrated territory after territory, state after state, and land after land, till he swept the great globe and culminated in sublime and unimpeached legitimacy in the august London Lancet, my cup was full, and I said I was glad I had done it. I think that for about 11 months, as nearly as I can remember, Mr. X's daily mailbag continued to be swollen by the addition of half a bushel of newspapers hailing from many climes with the petrified man in them, marked around with a prominent belt of ink. I sent them to him. I did it for spite, not for fun. He used to shovel them into his backyard and curse. And every day during all those months, the miners, his constituents, for miners never quit joking a person when they get started, would call on him and ask if he could tell them where they could get a hold of a paper with the petrified man in it. He could have accommodated a continent with them. I hated X in those days, and these things pacified me and pleased me. I could not have gotten more real comfort out of him without killing him. Making an oyster. You can't make an oyster out of nothing, nor can you do it in a day. You've got to start with a vast variety of invertebrates, the belemnites, trilobites, jubicites, amalekites, and that sort of fry, and put them in to soak in a primary sea and observe and wait what will happen. Some of them will turn out a disappointment. The belemnites and the amalekites and such will be failures, and they will die out and become extinct in the course of the 19 million years covered by the experiment. But all is not lost, for the jubicites will develop gradually into encrinites and stalactites and blatherskites, and one thing and another as the mighty ages creep on and the periods pile their lofty crags in the primordial seas. And at last the first grand stages in the preparation of the world for man stands completed. The oyster is done. Now an oyster has hardly any more reasoning power than a man has, so it is probable that this one jumped to the conclusion that the 19 million years was a preparation for him. That would be just like an oyster, and anyway, this one could not know at that early date that he was only an incident in the scheme, and that there were some more to the scheme yet. A mysterious visit. The first notice that was taken of me when I settled down recently was by a gentleman who said he was an assessor and connected with the U.S. Internal Revenue Department. I said I had never heard of his branch of business before, but I was very glad to see him all the same. Would he sit down? He sat down. I did not know anything particular to say, and yet I felt that people who have arrived at the dignity of keeping house must be conversational, must be easy and sociable in company. So, in default of anything else to say, I asked him if he was opening his shop in our neighborhood. He said he was. I did not wish to appear ignorant, but I had hoped he would mention what he had for sale. I ventured to ask him how was trade, and he said, so-so. I then said that we would drop in, and if we liked his house as well as any other, we would give him our custom. He said he thought we would like his establishment well enough to confine ourselves to it, said he never saw anybody who would go off and hunt up another man in his line after trading with him once. That sounded pretty complacent, but barring that natural expression of villainy which we all have, the man looked honest enough. I do not know how it came about exactly, but gradually we appeared to melt down and run together, conversationally speaking, and then everything went along as comfortably as clockwork. We talked and talked and talked, at least I did, and we laughed and laughed and laughed, at least he did. But all the time I had my presence of mind about me. I had my native shrewdness turned on full head, as the engineers say. I was determined to find out all about his business in spite of his obscure answers. And I was determined I would have it out of him without his suspecting what I was at. I meant to trap him with a deep, deep ruse. I would tell him all about my own business, and he would naturally so warm to me during this seductive burst of confidence that he would forget himself and tell me all about his affairs before he suspected what I was about. I thought to myself, "My son, you little know what an old fox you are dealing with." I said, "Now, you never would guess what I made lecturing this winter and last spring." "No, I don't believe I could. Save me. Let me see. About $2,000, maybe? But no, sir. I know you couldn't have made that much. Say, $1,700, maybe." "Ha ha, I knew you couldn't. My lecturing receipts for last spring and this winter were $14,750. What do you think of that?" "Why, it's perfectly amazing. I will make a note of it." "And you say that this even wasn't all?" "All? Why, bless you, there was my income from the Daily War Whoop about 4 months. Well, about, what should you say to about $8,000, for instance?" "Say, well, I should say I should like to see myself rolling in such another ocean of affluence." "$8,000. I'll make a note of it." "Why, man, and on top of all this, am I to understand that you had still more income?" "Ha ha ha. Why, you're only in the suburbs of it, so to speak. There's my book, The Innocents Abroad, price $3.50 to $5, according to the binding. Listen to me. Look me in the eye. During the last 4 months and a half, saying nothing of sales before that, but just simply during the 4 months and a half, we've sold 95,000 copies of that book. 95,000. Think of it. Average $4 a copy, say. It's nearly $400,000, my son. I get half." "The suffering Moses. I'll set that down. 14,700. 58, 200 total, say. Well, upon my word, the grand total is about $213,000 or $14,000. Is that possible?" "Possible. If there's any mistake, it's the other way. $214,000 cash is my income for the year if I know how to cipher." Then the gentleman got up to go. It came over me most uncomfortably that maybe I had made my revelations for nothing. Besides being flattered into stretching them considerably by this stranger's astonished exclamations. But no, at the last moment, the gentleman handed me a large envelope and said it contained his advertisement, and I would find out all about his business in it, and that he would be happy to have my custom, would, in fact, be proud to have the custom of a man of such prodigious income, and that he used to think that there were several wealthy men in the city. But when they came to trade with him, he discovered that they barely had enough to live on, and that, in truth, it had always been such a weary, weary age since he had seen a rich man face to face, and talked to him, and touched him with his hands, that he could hardly refrain from embracing me. In fact, would esteem it a great favor if I would let him embrace me. This so pleased me that I did not try to resist, but allowed this simple-hearted stranger to throw his arms about me and weep a few tranquilizing tears down the back of my neck. Then he went his way. As soon as he was gone, I opened his advertisement. I studied it attentively for 4 minutes. I then called up the cook and said, "Hold me while I faint. Let Marie turn the griddle cakes." By and by, when I came to, I sent down to the rum mill on the corner and hired an artist by the week to sit up nights and curse that stranger, and give me a lift occasionally in the daytime when I came to a hard place. Ah, what a miscreant he was! His advertisement was nothing in the world but a wicked tax return, a string of impertinent questions about my private affairs, occupying the best part of 4 foolscap pages of fine print. Questions, I may remark, gotten up with such marvelous ingenuity that the oldest man in the world couldn't understand what most of them were driving at. Questions, too, that were calculated to make a man report about 4 times his actual income to keep from swearing to a falsehood. I looked for a loophole, but there did not appear to be any. Inquiry number 1 covered my case as generously and as amply as an umbrella could cover up an anthill. What were your profits during the last year from any trade, business, or vocation, wherever carried on? And that inquiry was backed up by 13 others of an equally searching nature, the most modest of which required information as to whether I had committed any burglary or highway robbery, or by any arson or other secret source of emolument, had acquired property which was not enumerated in my statement of income as set opposite to inquiry number 1. It was plain that the stranger had enabled me to make a goose of myself. It was very, very plain. And so I went out and hired another artist. By working on my vanity, the stranger had seduced me into declaring an income of $214,000. By law, $1,000 of this was exempt from income tax. The only relief I could see, and it was only a drop in the ocean. At the legal 5%, I must pay to the government the sum of $10,650 income tax. I may remark in this place that I did not do it. I am acquainted with a very opulent man, whose house is a palace, whose table is regal, whose outlays are enormous, yet a man who has no income, as I often noticed by the revenue returns, and to him I went for advice in my distress. He took my dreadful exhibition of receipts, he put on his glasses, he took his pen, and presto, I was a pauper. It was the neatest thing that ever was. He did it simply by deftly manipulating the bill of deductions. He set down my state, national, and municipal taxes at so much, my losses by shipwreck, fire, etc. at so much, my losses on the sales of real estate, on livestock sold, on payment for rent of homestead, on repairs, improvements, interest, on previously taxed salary as an officer of the United States Army, Navy, Revenue Service, and other things. He got astonishing deductions out of each and every one of these matters, each and every one of them. And when he was done, he handed me the paper, and I saw at a glance that during the year my income, in the way of profits, had been $1,250.40. Now, said he, the $1,000 is exempt by law. What you want to do is go and swear this document in and pay the tax on the $250. While he was making this speech, his little boy Willie lifted a $2 greenback out of his vest pocket and vanished with it. And I would wager anything that if my stranger were to call on that little boy tomorrow, he would make a false return of his income. Do you, said I, do you always work up the deductions after this fashion in your own case, sir? Well, I should say so. If it weren't for those 11 saving clauses under the head of deductions, I should be beggared every year to support this hateful and wicked, this extortionate and tyrannical government. This gentleman stands up among the very best of the solid men of the city, the men of moral weight, of commercial integrity, of unimpeachable social spotlessness, and so I bowed to his example. I went down to the revenue office, and under the accusing eyes of my old visitor, I stood up and swore to lie after lie, fraud after fraud, villainy after villainy, until my soul was coated inches and inches thick with perjury, and my self-respect gone forever and ever. But what of it? It is nothing more than the thousands of the richest and proudest and most respected, honored, and courted men in America do every year. And so I don't care. I am not ashamed. I shall simply, for the present, talk little and eschew fireproof gloves, lest I fall into certain dreadful habits irrevocably. Thank you for listening to Reading the Classics, and have a good evening.